Hello and welcome to this episode of the SRUC podcast. Perhaps some familiar voices for you here. This is our second time on the SRUC podcast. My name is Eli Blythe and I am joined by my colleague Lucy Thornton. Lucy, do you want to tell us a bit about what we're here to discuss today?
Yeah, absolutely. Hi, everybody. My name's Lucy. I'm one of the lecturers on the Wildlife and Conservation Management Programme based down at SRUC Barony Campus. And we are here today to talk about a really interesting topic, which has been named Seeing the Wood for the Degrees, which I think is a really catchy topic. So we are talking today about how to embed forest school and outdoor learning principles and ethos into tertiary and HE education.
Yeah, so this came about because we're now in our third year, I think, of FOLA, or fourth year of FOLA delivery now. And we have been looking more and more at how we can integrate what we're doing outside with what we do inside with our more traditional students. So what we're going to do today is we're going to discuss the four kind of areas we looked at.
So we've got four different topics that we've sort of come up with that work and hopefully fit in quite nicely as discussion topics for embedding the forest school and outdoor learning principles into our HE student programs. And the first one is, I'll run through them and then we'll talk about them individually. So the first one's failure-based learning. The second one is reflection with students and reflective practice. The third one is a little bit of a hot topic, and that is how we can work with students as partners in learning and teaching. And the final one is adaptive learning. And I think we should probably kick off with that one. And that is Eli's area of expertise. So, Eli, can you give us a little bit of a rundown about what you mean by adaptive learning? And then we'll have a bit of a chat about it.
Yeah. So I think a good place to start with is what this looks like in the woodlands. So adaptive learning, one of the sometimes points of contention with our students is lesson plans in forest school. Because you can go outside with all of the kit and all the best one in the world, but if your participants want to do something, learn something different, you just got to adapt. That's how it works in the woods. And trying to pen in a group of outdoor participants to a rigid thing that you want to do is very difficult. So you pick up a lot of adaptivity and flexibility skills. I was recently at the Northwest Institute for Outdoor Learning Conference and attended a wonderful workshop on the use of improv in education, which I thought tied in with this really, really well. That ability to see what we might in forest school call a play cue or a learning cue and say yes and to it and see if you can take it in a different direction. Okay. One of the great things about our students, particularly at the SRUC, is we have such a diverse range of students from different backgrounds who all bring a wealth of different knowledge with them. Some of them will have been working in industry. Some of them will have been working in a completely different industry, but have come over and have brought a lot of those transferable skills with them. Some of them are just fresh out of high school. Some of them have been doing lots of volunteering and have industry contracts. All these different things. Adaptive learning in the classroom is having that space to introduce perhaps a topic or a point for discussion and then follow where your students take it. Okay. It's really easy to fall onto the old reliable standard of the lecture format. You will sit there and I will tell you the things you need to know. Okay. And quite often we get feedback from students that they find that a lot easier to deal with, because they just have to sit and they don't have to be actively engaged and they can sort of turn off. However, the classes that tend to stick with students are the ones that they have been involved in shaping. That's what I'm meaning by adaptive learning.
So I have a question for you. I have lots of questions for you, actually. So in a forest school and outdoor learning setting, we should probably reiterate a little bit about sort of forest school and what forest school ethos really is. before we move on. So the Forest School ethos, the bits that we're kind of focused on here is that holistic development. So focusing a little bit on cognitive growth, physical development, emotional well-being, building resilience, self-esteem, etc. As well as thinking about reflective practice and observation and all of the lovely things that come within this bracket of learner-centered or learner-led. And I think that's kind of where we're talking about this adaptive learning. It needs to be, we're trying to promote more learner-led activities in a classroom setting. And it's actually maybe not for tertiary and HE students. It's easier for younger children in the woods, in the outdoors, because they just go in and they see the woods as their massive playground. And they go off and do that learner-centered or participant-led activity really naturally. When you bring that back into an HE setting and into a classroom setting, it's actually, I think it could be quite challenging. And I think the reason that I would find it quite challenging is because of that inbuilt. If you think about where our students have come from educationally, they've come from like a secondary school setting where they've kind of been told what to do. They expect to be told what to do. There's a lesson plan that's potentially quite rigid. There's learning outcomes and all of that kind of thing. So it's actually, it's completely different for them. They have to really adapt to that change. How do you think they feel when you set a kind of more learner-led task? How does that land with them?
It will really depend on the group. So groups who have known, particularly you and I and our shenanigans, tend to be like, oh, okay, right, we're doing. I think you got them to do a newscast or something a couple of weeks ago.
A news recording, yeah.
News recording. They sort of get into it. But initially, they tend to get a little bit almost spooked. And you tend to get feedback of like they'll immediately ask for some boundaries, and they'll immediately ask for like, but what is it you want me to do? And that can be quite challenging. So in some ways, there is an aspect of building up to this. So starting out with the small choices, we can build up to bigger ones and bigger ones. Because at the end of the day, they're going to go forward into a workplace where likely, particularly for conservationists, they are going to have to learn adaptive management on their own.
Mm-hmm.
And they are going to have to, you know, they're not going to have someone over their shoulder all the time going, do this, do that. They're going to have to use their best judgment, see what different directions they can go in.
It's really interesting that you've sort of said that they find it quite challenging and that they almost look a little bit like rabbit in the headlights when you say you set a task. So I've set tasks, as Eli was saying, where students are worked put into differentiated groups, so mixed ability groups, with a topic. Sometimes I give them a topic, sometimes I give them choice of a topic, and they are to create a news program, newsroom recording of a certain topic. It's usually a wildlife conflict or something a little bit contentious where they've got different roles and they can interview scientists and conservationists and landowners and all that kind of thing. And when I set it and say, right, you've got 30 minutes, I get almost like a shocked look come back from the class with maybe a couple of students who go, yes, we get to do drama. But the rest of them find it really, really difficult. And that is mirrored when we take them out into the woods. So when we take them out into the woods for outdoor learning sessions or for forest school or woodland wellbeing type sessions where we give them quite a lot of free time, as soon as we say, okay, you've got some free time to go and mooch about, do what you fancy, there's some activities if you want, there's some whittling, there's a hammock, they don't know what to do. They really rely on that guidance or that structure. What do you think we could do to support them? I know you've mentioned sort of springboarding small choices, but what could we do further to really enhance their kind of capabilities?
I think that's a really good question. I think allowing them, and this is something that we're going to come on to later, to have the space to explore things going wrong. Particularly when we're in a very success-focused learning model. of your achievement is marked by your success in a topic, not by what you learn through it not going well. So that's supposed to be like, it's all right, this doesn't go right. Setting expectations rather than boundaries, I think, is also important. Some really interesting feedback I've had from other colleagues and student support staff has been a sense of perfectionism amongst students of I need as much time as possible, I have to get this exactly right, and trying to set the expectation of, if I give you 5 minutes, I'm not expecting a thesis, I'm expecting 3 bullet points in the back of a post-it note. And if we give you 30 minutes, we're expecting, you know, maybe half a page or something, or that kind of expectation. And there is that sort of perception that they have to get it right, and setting the expectation of there isn't a right, because there often isn't in the field. If you get 3 or 4 conservationists in a room, you will end up with 3 or 4 different management strategies, because Absolutely. There are many different approaches mm-hmm. to things. So I think setting the expectation for them rather than setting a boundary.
I like that. And I like that you don't have to get it right first time, especially formatively. And I think because there's so much emphasis put on summative assessment, where students are submitting a final report or something like that, and then actually it does matter if they get it right or not. But in the lead up to that, I think we need to practice getting it wrong and what that feels like. And I think maybe we're coming into a bit of a movement towards that, but actually building on that resilience and that bounce back ability to receive some feedback. It might not be the feedback that you want. Doesn't matter. Try again next time and do this, and this to improve, and take the positivity and take the fact that, yes, it's not perfect, but what can I do next time? And I think lessons from certainly from Forest School really enhance that. So I think, yeah, if we can try and utilize the Forest School ethos a little bit more in that learning process, I think you're absolutely onto something there.
I think the last thing I'd want to add is an understanding of what you do as a practitioner or a lecturer or somebody leading that space of when things go in a direction you weren't expecting. Because they will, because you might have started the class intending to talk about invasive species and you've ended up on the land management practices of X, Y, or Z. And being able to take wherever it is that they've ended up, recognize the journey that they've gone on to get there, and see, right, I can see that we started with a thought about grey squirrel management, and then we were looking at woodlands, and then we were looking at national strategy, and that's how we've come to this space. So there's actually quite a bit of learning and quite a bit of cognitive jumping that's gone on there. And being able to link things back to where you were seeing. This is my seeing that forest. Because it's really easy to go, but they didn't fulfill the objective, did they? But it's just not in the shape that you were expecting it to be in. Just because it's not a round scone doesn't mean it's not a scone.
That's a really good point. I can't make scones. All of my scones are flat like pancakes, but it doesn't mean they're not scones.
This is true.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. I think we can go round and round the houses and come back to a point. And I think that's what it is, isn't it? That's what learning is all about. That's experiential learning and bringing it all back full circle. And where did we jump off along the way? And as practitioners, as lecturers, we have to be adaptable as well. And I think maybe modelling adaptability in our sessions also works really well. And I'm quite happy to put my hand up and say, this isn't really going where I wanted it to go, but never mind, let's crack on and see where it leads. Let's be adptable and see how that goes. And hopefully that gives them an opportunity to feel safe to practice their own levels of adaptability. Shall we move on to another topic? I wonder if we, so this is one of my topics. Shall we?
To ask you the question?
Yeah, I think you should ask me the question on reflection, please.
So Lucy, reflection is something you are incredibly keen on. You lead on it in our Forest and Outdoor Learning courses. You have got endless notebooks filled with reflective questions and reflective prompts and reflective activities. Where do you think reflection falls in with our tertiary learning students?
Yes, you're right. I do like reflection. I'm a big advocate for reflective practice in my own teaching, and I also am a big advocate for it in our learners. However, I would say if we were to do a comparison here of forest school and outdoor learning, I would suggest it falls much more naturally in that setting, because we end every session certainly with a reflection. Certainly in forest school, but also in outdoor learning as well, you would probably naturally end with a plenary, which is very reflective, whether it's what did you find challenging today? What successes have you had today? All that kind of lovely stuff. What have you done this week that you weren't able to do last week, for example? So it comes quite naturally in an outdoor learning setting. But then when we try and translate that into tertiary and HE learning in, I'm going to use a classroom as an example here, I don't know if it's happening enough. And I would like to put the point forward to say that it should certainly be happening an awful lot more. So whether it's coming back to that adaptability, actually, and that what you've just been talking about, Eli, in this sense. So when students maybe try something and they don't succeed, the follow-up to that cycle, on that bit of the cycle, is to reflect on that. So an active reflection: what did I do? What worked? What didn't work? And what do I need to do next time to do better? So that's self-reflection leading to self-awareness. I don't think we do it enough. I think we can certainly embed it more in our classes through maybe self-evaluation and peer evaluation.
So we've just finished term two for our HE students, and we're halfway through semester two for our degree level students. Quite often what we say to our students is, have you read the feedback? You've got to read the feedback. And I was saying this to the third years about 20 minutes ago. I was like, there's an extra part to this, is to go back and to look at that piece of work again and actually see what you would do different now it's out of your head, now the deadline's out of the way. How would you fit this reflection into our very busy 10-week terms?
It's a really tricky one, isn't it? And I don't have an answer to it, but I think what we could actually do, instead of making a reflective event at the end, so once feedback has been given, we bring all the students back in and they reflect, and we provide the opportunity. We also have to provide an opportunity for them to be independent learners. So we give them that information. This is what we recommend you do with it. Go and be an independent learner, which is a whole different side topic. But what I think we could be doing is providing opportunities for students to reflect in small bite-sized chunks at more regular opportunities. So maybe at the beginning of a session, you could ask them to set their own goals for the session. What did they want to get out of it? Where do they see themselves at? And it's coming back to that, mindset, that growth mindset. So providing opportunities for students to go, actually, I'm going to choose, I'm not going to go for the easy option this time. I'm going to go for a slightly more challenging option. And then at the end of the session, provide an opportunity in a plenary activity, for example, for them to reflect on how that went. Did they think that they'd be able to succeed at that slightly more challenging task? Did they find it difficult? And if so, how did they find it difficult? And what do they need to work on? What skills do they need to work on? I think also peer reflection is really, really important, and I can't ignore it. I think it's hard, and I think students find it very difficult. But I think you get an awful lot from it. If you're sat with somebody, if you work together as a team, and then you ask each other, how did I do? You're going to get a fairly honest response if you feel like you're in a safe space to be able to do that. But I think reflection comes with, I think it comes with its challenges. I don't think we do it naturally, because I believe that people, I'd be interested to know your thoughts on this, Eli. I think that people maybe see reflection as self-criticism, and it becomes negative feedback or negative self-talk, as opposed to focusing on the positive, the negative, and the area for development, which is what reflection should be. What are your thoughts on that?
I think there's always a risk with reflection as looking in. I always think of reflection as more of a forest pool than a mirror, that you see a slightly warped reality. And that's where having those other perspectives coming in is really useful. I often find with students who sort of saying, yeah, but I seem to be failing everything. And I'm like, I'm not, you're not. See, mm-hmm. This is where you started. Look at where you are now, and getting them to reflect back on that journey and how they're sort of progressing. Because very much when you're in the moment, it's hard to see how far you've come. But there is definitely a potential for it to get very, very insular, and that reflection to become more and more distorted with that focus on the negative. And it's where the key practice in any reflection is those next steps. Where do I go from here? Yeah. And working out an actual actionable move forward rather than just yelling at yourself.
yeah, absolutely. I think that actionable move forward is quite nice. And I think we probably do document that in our year tutor tutorials, in our one-to-one sessions. We sort of ask students to reflect on how far they've come, and we maybe focus on their achievements, and they get to document that, and then we pull that piece of paper back out, and in 6 months' time we look at it again and see how far they've come, which is quite a, it's an objective-driven system. Whereas if we were just asking, like you would in forest school, as you're wandering around, if you were asking questions, oh, how did you find that? What was the process there? Did you find anything difficult? Are we walking around our classrooms, and are we walking around on our field trips when students are carrying out practical work, asking those same questions and just getting them to think that little bit more? Oh, I've just set a pitfall trap. Walking up to the student and saying, are you happy with that? You know, did you find anything challenging? What methods did you use? Where did you get that from? And just maybe prompting those, rather than, I feel like we're always quite rushed to get the job done. And then the practical activities happened, the class topic has happened, and then we rush to the end of the PowerPoint slide or the activity or whatever it is that we're doing. It's like the bell going off, isn't it, in primary and secondary school for lunchtime, and you feel like you've lost them. But actually, we haven't provided that really beautiful opportunity to go, how do you feel? How did that land for you? Have a chat with each other, because then the more we do that, the more it becomes natural. But I don't think it comes naturally to humans to reflect.
I think it's actually really key, those skills, to the underlying sort of scientific principles and scientific process of being able to look back at it and go, why didn't this work? What do I feel about it? What could I change? What could I do different? What went well? What didn't go so well? You do sometimes come across instances where you get the opposite of the sort of the negative self-talk, which is that everything is great and fine and there's no need for change or development. And in some ways that can be just as harmful. I would say it was a key part of our classroom, and I'm definitely planning on integrating it more in field trips and sort of class sessions and things, particularly for any sessions where we've got externals coming in, or we're doing some presentations or anything like that.
I think it's an easy win. I think it's a really easy win. If you've got a bank as an educator, if you've got a bank or a metaphorical bum bag of questions, reflective questions that you can ask, and you've just got them churning around in your head, and at any available appropriate moment, you can ask a reflective question. I think the more you do that, the easier it becomes. And ultimately, those metacognitive skills that we're wanting our students to be able to develop for the big wide world of work and for their future, ultimately, that your little reflective question could really enhance that. And I think also this is going to happen more anyway, naturally, just through assessment and through learning and embedding reflective practice into more of our assessments. I think that will be really valuable. So, Eli, you've popped on this list Another catchy title, failure-based learning. I would love to hear a little bit more about that, please.
So as you know, Lucy, I do love a snappy title, which is why this one is particularly evocative. So failure-based learning. I've been having lots of conversations with students over the last couple of months. I run a lot of modules which are quite public speaking focused. They're things about leadership, things about education, that kind of thing. And I've been having conversations with students about doing presentations and how they're finding them really anxiety inducing. They're quite concerned. And they get very stuck in the cycle of what could go wrong and all of the things that could happen, and X, Y, and Z. And I'm having these conversations with them about, well, so what if it goes wrong? They've often said to me, so I know I'll have to do this eventually, like when I go work somewhere, but I don't want to do it just, it's too much just now. And sort of recognizing that that's, this space is for getting things wrong. Okay. So if you're running an education session, one of our students do, and things go absolutely wrong, and the school group you're working with go completely wild, and there's banana skins on the ceiling, and everything, what will happen is I will step in and the teacher will step in, and it'll be fine. And you get the opportunity to learn from that experience. I think a lot of our students think that you and me and our colleagues sort of like arrived at like lecturing or outdoor education or rangering as like fully functional people who've never done anything wrong. And I have run so many sessions that have gone wrong. And I have sometimes, you know, chop down the wrong tree, or all the other things that you do, and you go, oh, that didn't work. And having those experiences of things not working is so much more valuable than getting it right every time.
Absolutely. And this lends itself really nicely to what you were talking about adaptability as well. And it lends itself really nicely to reflection. So it's almost as if we planned this. What you're telling me there, where you say, so what, it's just reminded me of one of the reflection models, actually, of what, so what, now what. And actually, I think it's that now what that's a real focus here, because we can all highlight what went wrong or where the failure happened. And we can all surmise, maybe we embiggen it in our brains, but we can all surmise what might have gone wrong and what consequences that might have. Eli stepping in to save the day, etc. But actually, the most important part of this is the now what. And I suppose it's prompting that just really informal discussion, isn't it? That now what? And yeah.
I think our first and second years operate on a first attempt, second attempt system. So our third and fourth years don't. And it's entirely possible to get through first and second year with never having to do a second attempt. But I would argue that the students who manage to do that struggle perhaps more when they get to the grade banding in third and fourth year. Because if you get a second attempt, you get a list of feedback, which you then have to read, rather than if you pass, because you don't have to read your feedback if you passed. You've clearly done everything. And you have another go. And you try again, and you add bits, and you take bits away, or you look at things a second time. And when it then comes to suddenly being graded in third and fourth year, you've got so much more experience at looking things again.
Mm-hmm. How can, I'm just mulling this over, and I'm linking it back now to the old forest school principles and the outdoor learning side of things. In forest school, how is this comparable or not? So what's the similarities and differences in this failure-based learning? What would we do in a forest school or outdoor learning setting that's different?
Oh, absolutely. So I was just thinking about mallets. So every time we do a forest school, we do a forest school training with our students. We do making a mallet. And over the years, you and I have gotten so much better at teaching people how to make mallets. And it just means that the mallets now last significantly longer than they did at the start. And they take about 2 hours less to make. And we're able to have that experience in forest school because the woodlands are they're a very forgiving atmosphere. Because, and I'm going to get a little bit floaty here perhaps, because you've got this ongoing cycle of regeneration around you. We have things growing up from the earth for the first time. We have got trees that have grown and hit an obstacle and gone round a corner or merged into another tree or had a bit fall off and gone at a different angle. And then we've got that decomposition cycle of things that have died, that have fallen off and are now returning their nutrients and their life to the soil. And thus starting that cycle over again. And I think having that around you makes you be a bit kinder to yourself. Because there's another stick. It's all right. If you're using natural fibres to make your basket, well, they'll rot down in a few weeks. And that's fine if it didn't work out. And I think in classrooms, which are often quite... I don't want to say it's quite sterile, but we don't see examples of that happening. We don't put student examples of work that didn't pass up on the walls. Would it be useful if we did?
Yes.
Because then we could go, yeah, this one didn't pass, but this is what it looked like the next time it came around. Mm-hmm. Okay, anonymized, of course. We spent time last week doing our dissertation training or dissertation marking training and or standardization. And we looked at two dissertations which had gotten certain grades. And the ability to go through and sort of grade those for our students, for them to do that grading experience and some anonymized examples, would be invaluable.
Mm-hmm. And we can do that. Mm-hmm. That is something that I would have put in as a suggestion to this little segment, I think, is that we absolutely can provide them with examples of student work that are of varying different, what's the word I'm looking for?
Layers.
You have to edit this out. Grades.
But anything where it's that opportunity to grow, to say, well, actually, I didn't get it this time. That's okay. I've learned some new things. It's one of the underlying principles from sort of Rosper's. This is one of my favourite stories I love to tell. So Rosper's playground training, which is that majority of accidents in playground are caused by children running into other children. But that is a valuable life experience.
We've all learned that lesson at some point in our life, haven't we?
Yeah. It's closely followed by children running in front of swings. That's a valuable thing to learn. So I think overall, failure-based learning has a place in our classroom, and I think it has a place in our students' understanding. Because it's really easy to get stuck into the, but I am failing, I am not doing well, but you are still learning. Mm-hmm. And that growth is still happening. I'm sure I can make a wonderful tree metaphor out of this. We looked at tree rings and seen the years where there was lots of stress and years where there was lots and lots of opportunities available. See the different rings. But tree is still growing,
mm-hmm.
Regardless of what's happening.
Growth. Yeah, I like that. I feel like that there is there's definitely a metaphor that we can play with there for our forest school leader training. I also just wanted to mention, because this is what people who are listening to this might be thinking, is the first attempt in learning is fail, isn't it? When people say to you, you failed. No, it was a first attempt in learning. And that's what we always get taught and what we always get told. I have taken that forward from my own failures. It's fine. I didn't fail. I was just still learning and growing. Maybe there's a lot to be said for that.
That's the first time I've heard that acronym.
What? No way.
I've never heard first attempt in learning before. That's exciting.
first attempt in learning. I am sure that there will be an opposition to the first attempt in learning, because there always is. But I remember it as that, and I would still say to certainly my stepdaughter who comes home and says, "I failed this." No, you didn't. You're still learning. It's just a first attempt.
Absolutely.
Go. Shall we talk about students as partners?
Well, I'm going to ask you to talk about students as partners, because students as partners is one of these wonderful nebulous things which kind of, like, it turns up in loads of strategy documents and it's like, oh yes, we're in full embracing students as partners. But what does it actually mean, Lucy?
Well, it is one of those elusive topics. You're absolutely right. And it's certainly coming up more and more. So the idea of utilising students as partners in sort of design of curriculum and assessment and even to a point learning materials as well is one of those that's on the agenda in certainly in our new seedable curriculum at SRUC, where we are looking at, or we've actually probably just started experimenting with utilizing students as partners and collaborators in various different forms of educational development. So the reason that it, and the research suggests that it provides students with feelings of empowerment, because they get to choose. So they get to put their ideas in the pot when it comes to assessment design, for example. If we're surveying students when we're revalidating a degree program, we're asking them what went well, which modules they enjoyed, why they enjoyed them, and which modules they would like to have seen on the suite of modules that we're offering within the program and why. They feel like their opinions matter, and their opinions do matter. And I think if we're seen to be responding to their comments and their feedback and their suggestions, then they feel a sense of empowerment and also a sense of ownership, particularly if it's in relation to assessment choice. So where I've used this in an HE setting is in assessment design. So I co-deliver a module. I won't take full responsibility for this. I co-deliver a module called Action for Biodiversity, which is a fourth year degree module, and it's delivered cross-campus by a cross-campus teaching team. And in order to ensure that students are able to collaborate on the assessment design, we allow them to put assessment topics. So they have to write a policy brief. We set that bit. So they have to prepare a policy brief as part of an assessment, but the topic comes from them. So each campus puts all of their ideas into the pot, and then we go away, have a look at them, and we choose four or five of the ones that we think probably have the most research out there, the ones that will be a sufficient enough challenge for the level, and ones that we think that students will succeed at. And we put them into the assessment brief and send it out to students. So students and staff and lecturers have collaborated together to create that assessment output. And actually, it's worked really well. And some of the subjects that have come up wouldn't necessarily be topics that we would have chosen as a teaching team, really, because we would tend to err on our own expertise or our own interests, whereas actually getting the students interested, it makes it more interesting for us as well to mark, because it's something completely new. From a forest school and outdoor learning setting, just bringing this back full circle, I've seen our participants working as partners in a sense that when we do our reflection in our reflective practice at the end of a session, which, by the way, happens rigidly, we have circle time, we have that time to check in. I don't know why it can't translate to a classroom. Anyway, we have that time. One of the questions that I ask them is, what do you fancy doing next week? What do you fancy doing next session? What have you got out of this session? What projects have you got going on next week that I can help you with, or I can bring in? And they give me that information. So they're collaborating in the almost in the planning of the next session, which is absolutely right, because it's meant to be learner-led. So it's not meant to be me singing and dancing at the front. It's all about them.
We actually find this when we're doing our forest school leader training, in that you and I, every time we're like, ah, let's write a timetable. So we write a timetable. And then by about 10 o'clock on the first day of this like 5-day of training, we have thrown the timetable out of the window. Because the students have come in and we've not met them before, and they've gone, actually, we're really, really strong in this. We really just want to get out in the woods. Or it's actually a really, really wet and miserable morning. Can we stay in this morning and do risk assessments? I do have to say that's a bit of a lie. Nobody has actually ever asked specifically to do risk assessments, which is a shame because I'm quite like them. But, you know, we do this with our I'm going to call it internal teaching. We do this with our classroom teaching in that we, you know, we write lesson plans and we write session plans and term plans and all these other plans. And then having that flexibility for the students go, actually, no, we're actually really strong on stakeholder engagement or something. But can we come back round to this, round to a different issue? Can we look at this from this angle? I've had it with some of the groups this year who were looking at evidence-based conservation management, and they said, look, can we have an extra session on this? Which we did. We went back and ran a specific session, so they got to get some more of what they were specifically interested in out of their learning.
Yeah. I think it's really, really powerful. I think it's a very powerful tool. When I've been a learner in any setting, whether it be outdoors or in my own professional development, if I've been given a choice, I often prefer that, particularly where our students are concerned, where they might, as you said right at the very beginning, Eli, they come from a variety of different backgrounds. So by offering them a choice in an assessment, for example, or a topic, or in a direction that they want to go in for a certain output, then they can lean into an area that they are interested in that they might want to go out and get a job in that particular topic. So it's giving them the flexibility to do something that they enjoy whilst also providing them with a bit more challenge. So they might go off-piste and want to choose a topic that they know nothing about. So it's giving them that that choice and that freedom, I guess. I had a question. I love that I'm asking the questions on my topic now. I had a question, and it was about allowing too much choice. So I was thinking of like the challenges of students as partners, and I wondered if you'd come across any challenges.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. It's this thing of, it's really hard to know what you need to learn before you've learned it. So we've had, or certainly if I've had experience with students in the past where we've been having discussions on certain topics and they have really wanted to go off down a particular angle. They want to look at maybe the globalization angle on it, or something like that. And depending on what my outside constraints are, and that might be assessment briefs, or it might be X, Y, and Z, it depends on what we can and can't entertain, which possibly goes directly in contradiction with my adaptive adaptive learning, because it's entirely possible to spiral yourself off a cliff. Mm-hmm. I've worked with student groups in the past who had a very definite idea of what they thought they should be learning, and when possible, you know, we entertained that as much as we could, but at the end of the day we had the understanding of actually what were the valuable skills, mm-hmm. for that module, for that industry, for that, what was the thing they actually needed to get out of it. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't what they thought, what their perception of it was.
That's really interesting, isn't it? And I've had a similar scenario actually that I'm just thinking about now. And again, I'm trying to draw comparisons between being outdoor inside of a nature connection session, a woodland wellbeing session, and allowing freedom of choice and learner-led sessions with what we do in the classroom. And now one of the things that I try and do in a classroom is offer opportunities for students to work in groups, pairs, or on their own. And often in my head, I would like them to work in groups because for my outcomes, they're going to help each other and support each other better. But sometimes they all choose to work on their own. And because I've provided that opportunity of choice and they're working as students, as partners with me, I can't then backtrack. And I think that sometimes causes a problem because actually them working alone, they don't benefit from that sometimes. And I think because they're still learning about how they learn best and how they learn certain topics best, they don't know yet which one to choose. And actually working alone sometimes is the best option because group work's scary, but actually they might benefit more from group work. So it's up to me as an educator to know when to use students as partners as an appropriate tool.
I think that's there's actually quite a good link to be made to our Forest School sort of practitioner there of it's really easy if you're coming into a Forest School that you don't know the practitioner, you don't know the participants, to go, oh God, this is chaos. There are things happening everywhere. What's that child doing? Who's got a knife? All these kind of things. Whereas actually we do set boundaries on that partnership in our Forest School settings. You can climb a tree, but only as high as my shoulder. Okay, because I'm not getting a ladder to get you down. Mm-hmm. or you could do whatever you want, but within this area.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And it's that thing of we might call it redirecting in the forest. Okay, it's like, I can see you're trying to set fire to the leaf litter. How about we redirect this into some fire lighting in the fireball? And then we can do marshmallows. It's on that same sort of topic, but...
Yeah, I think you are absolutely right. And I think if we take that back into a classroom setting in tertiary and HE learning, it's a case of, if I use that example of group work, maybe I can say you can work in groups, but they can be small groups. They don't have to be big groups. Or you can work on your own for this bit, but I'd like you to work in groups for that bit. Maybe it's coming up with a bit of a compromise. And actually maybe that then also instills a little bit of trust and safety in our collaboration moving forward, I would say.
I think so, which brings us around very neatly to the future.
Dun, dun, dun. So we've talked about four different topics. We've talked about adaptive learning, reflective practice, failure-based learning, and utilising students as partners in tertiary and HE education. Eli, what do you think the future is for some of these concepts that we've discussed today?
I think that I think all of these have a place within our tertiary systems. I think the next couple of years within education are going to be quite interesting. There's a lot of external pressures facing education, particularly at a tertiary level. We've got less university places. We've got changes in how we do our assessments and management. Industry is changing, those kind of things. But in a lot of ways, all of those external pressures are very much the same as they have always been. I think a focus on student resilience is going to become very central to that. That role of, can you be an independent learner? Can you grow from your mistakes? And I think adaptive learning, as we make our classrooms more accessible places, as we have a wider understanding of the rich tapestry of backgrounds that our students have, it's going to be a more central part of things. However, all of these require space and time and, as practitioners, opportunities for things to not work.
Absolutely. I see in the future. So I have a real a lovely idea that will possibly never happen, but I'll keep lobbying for it. I would really like all students in tertiary and HE education to have access to nature and to be in nature, and actually have a little practice of some of this, some of these ethoses, principles that we've just been discussing. But failing that, I think a movement towards that holistic approach, that organic delivery, embedding some of these principles into our delivery, whether it be a quick reflective check-in and make that just happen naturally, adding in reflective practice to our assessments so students get good at it, working in groups, working on our own, being more self-aware. I think all of those things provide opportunities to grow and to take transferable meta skills out into the big wide world of work. But I think the challenge is that we are always in our sector, we're always going to be limited by assessment outputs. And I think that's tricky sometimes.
That does bring me on to some feedback that we had from student group this year, which was really interesting, which was we're prone to a tangent in our department or two. We are all really interested in our topics. We know loads of things. We want to tell our students loads of things. Sometimes our students come out with things that are really interesting and we pick up on that. And we got some feedback from students, which was, why do you keep telling us things that aren't in the assessment? Which I thought was fascinating.
Yes.
Yeah. And I was like, it doesn't have to be in the assessment to be important.
Or for us to share it with you.
And it was that idea of, actually, there is life outside your assessment brief. There is a bigger scope of knowledge and understanding than what we can include in a 80-word report or a 7-minute presentation. Or
it's so interesting, isn't it? Because anything extracurricular that doesn't link to an assessment, so it isn't a timetabled session that we put on for students, whether it be an opportunity to go out and do a wetland bird survey, or whether it's an opportunity to go and build a raised bed in the walled garden, or to go out into the woods and light a campfire and swing in a hammock and roast some marshmallows just to take some time aside, students will vote with their feet and they will be less inclined to attend those sessions because they're either working on their assessments or the thing that we've invited them to doesn't have anything to do with their assessment. So why should they come? That is the problem that we have. We need to find this more holistic approach to learning where everything is just as important as the next. And I don't know what that looks like, but I would love for that to happen in the future.
I think you've just found our next podcast topic.
Excellent. Sign me up right now.
And on that note, I think we're going to bring this to a close. We have been Eli Blythe and Lucy Thornton from the Wildlife and Conservation Management team based at SRUC Barony. If you'd like to hear more from us, we have got another podcast in this feed entitled What is Forest School Anyway? And if you're interested in the Forest and Outdoor Learning course, we run the Forest and Outdoor Learning course at level 8, which is the leadership course, level 5, which is the assistance course. We also run CPD sessions and we have other events on throughout the year. If you're interested, come and find out what we're about.